Hey everybody, nice to see you. So, I'm half joking to friends of mine that the heavenly messengers are out in full force in my life. Those of you who know those teachings, the heavenly messengers are aging, sickness, and death, as well as a monastic who inspires the Buddha to practice. So, I don't know how it is for you, but they are out and about in my life. And what it does for my teaching is make me very interested in what the essence or what the through line is. It has a way of kind of reprioritizing or magnetizing what's important. So Hafiz, the mystic poet, said, "The subject tonight is love. Tomorrow night, the subject is also love. And the following night, and for every night from here on out, I know of no better subject until we all die." So this through line of love, we can read as, I think we can see it as at the heart of any map that we look at in these teachings. So I heard a teacher the other day quote an early teaching that I had heard many times, but for some reason, it struck me so strongly when he read it. There are some cases in which a person overcome with pain, her mind exhausted, grieves, mourns, laments, and becomes bewildered. Or one overcome with pain, her mind exhausted, instead comes to search. Who knows a way or two to stop this pain? Who knows a verse or two that speaks to the ending of this pain? I tell you, friends, that stress results either in bewilderment or in search. Stress, discontent, dissatisfaction results either in bewilderment, more ignorance, or search. So, what really struck me in this, I've always liked the sutta, but just the innocence of this question, right? Who knows a way or two or a verse or two that will speak to this discontent, this dissatisfaction, this dis-ease. Who knows a way out of this? So it's such an earnest or sincere question. When I hold that in my mind or in my awareness, I can feel the way in which all of the teachings are a response to this sincere question. The sincere asking, who knows a way out of this? Who knows about the ending of this? And that's really the turning, right, between being caught in a habitual cycle of reiterating suffering or a turning. What else is possible? Right. What else is here? So I think all teachings are an answer to this question. So if we keep this as at the heart, maybe you can feel this is very different than a self-help regime, right? This is very different than a get better quick scheme. Or an effortful slog. Right? So this is a whole different approach to struggle. Right? Who knows a way or two to address, to alleviate this discontent, disappointment, disease. So what I'd like to speak about tonight, kind of with that through line or that heart, as we come to the end of the 10 Oxfording pictures. So I know I've been kind of weaving in and out a little bit in the series, and maybe some of you have as well, or some of you have been diligently tracing every step of that journey. But it's a journey through 10 pictures that have verses accompanying the images, right? So this is a practice journey. This is a story, and it also is an instructional teaching. So what I'd like to speak about, we've been going through each picture. There are 10, roughly one per month. And now coming to the end and like looking back on the journey or looking back on this particular map. So if you haven't been able to attend many or all, I think this still should apply. I'd like to kind of just look back and pull out a few themes. So that the title of the talk, my talks don't always have titles, but lately they've been appearing in alliteration. I don't know why that happens, but that maps, metaphor, and the mystery. A good theme for revisiting or looking back over this particular practice journey. Maps, metaphor, and the mystery. Right? So this teaching of the Oxfording pictures is it's a story, but it's also a map. It's a practice map. And like any map, it helps us kind of locate or orient ourselves. It's a skillful means. And so kind of the first question, and I'm sure we asked this in some form at the beginning, is how do we relate to the maps that we're given, the maps of the teachings, right? So we're given so many maps. Four Foundations of Mindfulness is a map. The Four Noble Truths is a map. The Awakening Factors, right? The Brahmaviharas. They're all maps to how the heart mind disentangles from suffering. Right? Who knows a way or two out of this pain? All answers to that question. But how do we relate to the maps? The 10 of this, the 12 of that, the 4 of this, the 3 of those, right? Are these maps that are kind of imposed on top of our experience? Or are they kind of an invitation to enter into our experience and our lives more fully? Okay. So I would really suggest the latter. They're an invitation to enter our experience more fully. They're guideposts, they're signposts. So some of us get enamored with the maps, comparing them, contrasting them. Some of us start resenting the maps. Oh, this feels like way too much work. I'm just trying to get through the day. This is way too much. I can't take all this in. I can't possibly do it. Some of us resent them, right? But if we think of them all as skillful means that are answering a simple question or a simple call, then hopefully we can take in our own way simple pieces and themes and use them as an invitation really to enter our life more fully. One of my dear teachers, Willa Tanya Reed, often says, these teachings were offered out of compassion. Right? the way that you pick them up out of compassion. Pick them up out of compassion. Don't pick them up as another chore, another have to, as an ideal that we're supposed to live up to. Right? Pick them up out of compassion. Okay. So this map is also a story. And it's a universal story. It's a universal human story. In some way, it's every hero or heroine's journey, right? If you think about it. So there is something comfortable that's left. There's a search, a period of search. After maybe an initial spark or an initial impulse, there's a search I was talking about in the beginning. There's some conflict. There are aids in inner and outer that come to help in that conflict. And there's a transformation. There's a process of transformation. Right? There's a shift in view. And then in the end, there's an offering. There's a return and an offering. Right? So all of these, this is kind of every plot line, maybe, of every novel or every movie, right? They have to have all of these elements. So I know Philip Moffitt was here this weekend, and one thing I've always appreciated when I've heard him say it is that we can relinquish being the hero in our own movie, or being the star of our own movie, right? So this isn't an invitation to enter into a more elaborate narrative with yourself as the hero, right? But it's hopefully inspiring you to enter into a new relationship with the struggle in your life, wherever that appears. Right. So it calling us forward into transformation. So the very first picture, the actual figure is rather small. Right? And there are long grasses to the right and left of the figure. The figure is sort of expressionless and small, and starts searching through the grasses in the pasture of the world, it said, right? Searching for the ox, a glimpse of the ox, but it's nowhere to be found. By the end, after this struggle with the ox, after a period of harmony and joy, this picture of the figure riding the ox after a period of training, playing a flute, right? Being in harmony with the way things are, with one's own mind, being able to relax in repose. And then towards the end, the foreground and the background have shifted, so that the image of the figure is much larger and the background has receded. But again, it's not a, I don't think we need to think of this as like a puffed up hero coming, having conquered all. The description, there's a wide face, a wide, smiling, serene face. And there's a partial nakedness, so there's an openness. And the figure is returning to the world with extended hands, right? So that was the last image I think you contemplated last month. So returning to the world with extended hands, right? With something to offer, with receptivity, porousness, all of one's sensitivity, but with also a sense of center, right? There's a radiance and a knowingness in the figure at the end, right? So this invites us into, this is meant to invite us into a journey. This is not a straight line, right? This is not a finish line. This is something that we circle around and back again and again and again. Often seems to me like we can circle through these stages of practice even in one sitting, in one day, right? But especially with one challenge, like one struggle. We can enter into all of these stages as we start to orient towards any challenging circumstance that arises in our life. So again, not as a failure or flaw of ours when we experience challenge, but as kind of the compost for transformation, right? So one teaching says, stay in the soil of your life. Stay in the soil of your life. So most of us can't help this. I know many of you, I know our parents, right? Or caring for family members are entrenched and embedded in relationships. So we're in the soil of life. We may not have long periods where we can physically retreat, physically journey, where we can leave our external circumstances, but we always have the invitation and the possibility of making an inward journey, an inward movement, right? Wherever we are. Okay. So this is what the maps offer. Okay. So just to say by way of maps, you likely have found your own kind of resonant points or themes in here, but I find especially what has been extremely helpful for me in using the Eightfold Path as a map, as an invitation to include the whole of one's life as practice, are these three pillars of the Eightfold Path that are also throughout the 10 Oxherding pictures, right? So these three pillars or component parts of the Eightfold Path are sila, or ethical sensitivity, samadhi, or mind training, the mind gathered, collected, and punya, or wisdom, right? So these are always mutually supporting and reinforcing each other. And so especially paths that seem linear, like I start here, then I do this, and then transformation happens, and then I do that. It's much more helpful to think in terms of circles or in terms of three supporting pillars, right? So most of us come to practice very intent on the meditative training pillar, right? The samadhi pillar. Tell me what to do. Give me the instructions. Don't give me anything else. Leave me alone. Just let me do it, right? So I was definitely this way. I did this. But this is one aspect of the training. This is usually where we enter, right? This is the middle part of the Oxherding pictures where the figure, the person is struggling with the bull, right? The ox, struggling with one's own habit mind. So this is where many of us enter with the meditative technique, right? So just to know this as one aspect, but not the whole aspect. We also have the kind of ethical sensitivity. This is being sensitive to our relationships in the world, you know, how we are in the world. So this map starts with searching through the tall grasses, right? Like, distractions, things that seem to be overtaking us. We can't find our way, right? But we start to develop a kind of sensitivity, like what's actually affecting my heart and mind, right? There's a kind of deep listening that happens when we're sensitive to inner signals, outer cues, right? But also to our impact on one another. So we see this too in the end, in which it's really, I think this last picture is an expression of generosity, like with extended hands. This is just a generous offering. Right? So this is part of Sila as well. Right, how we relate to the world, and it changes. Maybe our perspective at the beginning is that we're being buffeted, we're being impinged, we're at the mercy of other people, of relationships. And perhaps as we go, we start to be less concerned, maybe with how we're being viewed, how we're being perceived, and more about what can we offer. What can we offer? So this is Sila, this development of ethical sensitivity. And it grows also as wisdom develops. So there's the Enzo symbol, that symbol of a circle in the center, in which we recognize our non-separateness, the non-separateness of all things, but also it may not come as an absolute flash. It may come in smaller moments of discernment, of a gradually deepening understanding that we are not separate from things. Right, that there is no solid, independent, constant manager or owner of experience. Right, so this is these teachings point to as well. Okay, as wisdom, that kind of wisdom grows, we mysteriously, in some degree, have more to offer. So this is just a little bit about the maps. For me, in diving into a lot of the different maps, which I really appreciate, these through lines of answering that question. Does anyone know a way or two out of this? And also those three pillars of Sila, Samadhi, and Banya. If I can find those reference points in the teaching of compassion, ethical sensitivity, mind training, training of our habits, and wisdom, transformation, I feel like I'm home, that those are reference points I can use. Right? So a map asks us to take on for a time a particular frame of reference, right? And they're effective because to the extent to which we can take on that frame of reference for a while, right? The four foundations, instead of the frame of reference being me as a separate person, the separate self, the world according to me, the reference becomes the body. There is a body. It becomes feeling tone. What is the tone that's present in this moment? Is it liking or disliking or kind of neutral? And it all unfolds from there. That is the frame of reference. Okay. This frame of reference is a story with verses that have universal themes, right? Connecting us to the human experience of search, of challenge, of wisdom and awakening and transformation, and of offering, right? So we're asked to take on this framework. And a wonderful thing about having a year to do it is that you have plenty of time to make the verses your own, to become a contemplative, right? In which we take a teaching and really steep in it and see how it changes our perception or our view during the day when we're in an argument, right? When our body hurts, when we get the diagnosis. Okay, so wherever you enter, so this is an invitation to enter wherever you'd like, right? Enter through the doorway of the training, the struggling with the ox, the teachings that offer really exquisite, specific techniques for working with one's mind. Enter through the doorway of generosity, you know, being in the world. Helping with any number of causes that we feel drawn to, right? Enter there. One of the renderings of the early poems from the early Buddhist nuns, one verse says, the path is like a bright, shining world. Enter wherever you'd like. Enter wherever you'd like. So it's not a straight line, right? But these elements weave together. So one tool that these teachings, I think, use beautifully, the ox herding pictures, is metaphor, right? Images. So for the sake of this talk, because I like the M's, I'm going to say metaphor, but I also mean metaphor and analogy and simile. You know? They're all teaching devices, right, that the Buddha used also. He was always comparing really profound teachings to aspects of life that people were very accustomed to. Right? People are probably very familiar with bulls, with ox, with agricultural metaphors and analogies. There was likely a strong felt resonance with the mention of these kind of themes. So. My appreciation of this particular teaching is that it allows us to use some images in our lives. Maybe ox aren't that evocative for us, right? But maybe the moon as it appears in a different image, or maybe just a more general sense of struggle. Right. So to use the images that arise in our lives And metaphors, I think, are particularly potent because they evoke a felt sense, right? So people often talk about things as being like merely metaphor, like an abstraction from experience. But I think it's all in the way we hold it. If we hold an image, stay with it, are attentive, listening, bring it deeply into our practice, it has the chance to take us deeper, right? To change our view. So metaphors, like art, inspire a kind of felt meaning that's individual for each of us. So using universal symbols, I think, allows teachings like this to really find each of us in our own way. This is, again, becoming a contemplative. What does this evoke in me? Not in a proliferating or analytical way, but what does this image evoke? As though you were sitting in front of a painting or hearing a piece of music, right? Or listening to a poem. I can't tell you the number of times I've offered teachings and people don't remember a thing that I've said, right? Nothing. But give me the name of that poem, right? So there's a phrase or an image, and that has some kind of resonance that is beneath the sort of surface froth of our ordinary discursive mind, right? It really speaks to the core of our experience being human. So we can use those images and let them change us. We can use a verse, we can use an image, we can use just a general theme or a word, right? Like struggle or opening. So I'll just offer a little bit on a few of the metaphors in here, and then love to hear from you also. But metaphors give us also a way of approaching the mystery of it, right? So one thing about maps is that they sort of give us sometimes the illusion that maybe if we don't have it all figured out, at least somebody does, right? So at least there's some track, right? Which in many ways there is. There's guidance and there's direction and there's deep aspiration. But there is no control, right? And there is no guarantee that it's all going to unfold swimmingly from here, right? So what images do as we approach different versions of the unknown is that they give us a way of going deeper and orienting differently to our own real lived felt experience. So just one a couple of things about that. So Dipa Ma, as many of you know, we all interpret images differently. And so to let your interpretation be your interpretation, that's how it works. So Dipa Ma, wonderful teacher of many of our teachers, a woman who never ordained but stayed living in her apartment in Calcutta with her grandchildren, coming in as she was giving talks while she was doing laundry. She helped kind of, she extended with open hands her experience of the teachings to everyone around her and managed to sort of transform her apartment building and her block But as scientists came in to test her in the 70s, they trekked into her little apartment and hooked her up to electrodes and studied her brain as they were starting to study meditation masters to see what brain changes would happen. This was in the early days of doing that. They found all sorts of extraordinary things, but in the context of images, they showed her Rorschach prints, those early prints that were given to people as a diagnostic tool to see your level of psychological functioning could somehow be discerned by what you saw in these images of, I think, ink stains on pieces of paper. So they showed her these images and waited for her response. And I believe, as the story goes, took her a few minutes of silence, like looking at the image, internalizing it. And she wove them all into Dharma talks that she offered back to the scientists, right? So, there's that saying, we see things not as they are, but as we are. Right? We see things not as they are, but as we are. So images often reflect back to us aspects of our own deeper experience. Right? So metaphors can do this. So there's the metaphor or the image, the analogy in these teachings of traces or footsteps. Those come up in several of the pictures. Right? So this, I think, is a very helpful metaphor, because there are many times in which the way forward is not clear, right? When there's overwhelm or confusion, and all we can sense is that maybe there's one step forward, right? Or we get just the echo or a glimpse of something that indicates a direction, right? So these come all the way through, these traces. In the image of the Enzo circle in the middle, the emptiness or non-separation or not self, depending on how you want to approach that. The last line is, here are the footsteps of the ancestors. Right? So even in this no-thingness, there are the traces of the ancestors, right? So the wise ones or the sages, the teachers, the mentors, right, have all perhaps like walked through these various places, offered teachings from these places, right? So we can think of these footsteps as part of our inheritance as practitioners, the best part of our inheritance, right? They're guideposts in the way that teachings are guideposts. They're offerings, right? But they're also places for us to stop and receive and inquire. What is this? And then it's also said that as we depart, you know, as the sense of self loosens, our sense of ownership over experience diminishes. Right? There isn't anything that we can claim as lasting as I, me, or mine, inside or outside. Right? But what we can have a lot of influence over. There's one verse that says, the only thing that I truly own are my actions. And they're reverberations, right? So as we walk, we're leaving these reverberations for others, these footsteps, mixing my metaphors, but we're leaving these footsteps or traces for others. Maybe as we go, or maybe at different points, our footsteps become kind of quieter, right? Maybe the echo or the wake that we leave is not so dramatic or jagged, right? Had a lot of, as I mentioned, death recently around me, sickness and death. And after someone passes, there is, there can be a lot of things in that process, grieving. But there is sort of like just the reverberation, or almost like the scent, the feeling that this person, having touched my life, shared in my life for a little while, left. There is an echo or a reverberation, some footsteps, traces, right? So again, these are images that can bring us close to our felt experience. We can't see them or hear them or feel them if we're rushing, right? Too much. Okay. And the second I mentioned is struggle, right? So how many people can feel or relate in some way to struggling with an ox to some degree? No? Some aspect of yourself, some relationship, some challenge. That sense of struggling with something wild and untamed, right? Unpracticed, right? So we can think of this as just our reactive, not just, but our reactive habit mind, right? How are we relating to what arises in this mind? We may have a number of reactions, but most of us have one or two core moves that we do when it's unpleasant. It's really good to know what a couple of your core moves, your core reactions are. Right? Do we withdraw or collapse or strike out or fight or brace or escape or get righteous? What is our mode of struggle, resistance? Right? So that's the second metaphor, that at least the one that I'm mentioning tonight, is just that struggle with the ox. Again, not to take that as a personal problem, but as very fundamentally part of the path. Another metaphor or image, as I mentioned, is playing the flute and coming home. So being in harmony, applying effort in a way that is not too tight, not too loose, so that the air actually moves through the flute and produces a harmonic sound, right? So in this picture, there's a sense of joy or delight. Our relationship with things has shifted. Maybe not for all time, maybe just for a moment, but there's a sense of coming into harmony with things, being in rhythm or in step with things. So lastly, there's this image of extended hands, which I've mentioned a few times and which I know you studied last month. So the hands are a wonderful metaphor, but also a felt experience of offering. So it's something that we can feel the difference between being extended and being contracted. We can feel the difference between a fist and an open hand, right? So one teacher, Zenju Earthlin Manuel, says in one of her teachings, one of her many teachings, she uses a lot of image, metaphor, feel both palms down when we sit, feel the kind of containment coming into integrity, feeling our way into a center, palms down, and then palms up, right? In which we're receptive, open, but also available to offer. Right? We can feel both of those. So entering into the market with extended hands. So we can always use phrases, we can use gestures like this, we can use images as reminders, we can use gentle inquiry questions, right? What is openness in this moment? What does it mean to extend in this moment? What does it mean to find the footsteps or find the traces in this moment? So these are universal themes: seeking, finding, returning, offering. These are part of the universal human story. So again, through line in all of this is a deep wish to come out of suffering, but also, maybe you can feel this in yourself, just a deep wish to evolve. I've been thinking about it lately. Can you feel this in yourself? Like a deep wish to evolve, to not be trapped in that cycle of samsara, which is quite repetitive, familiar, right? But that deep wish, that part of us that knows that transformation is possible, right? That knows that it's possible in this life. So the Buddha used so many similes for this unbinding, right? For this awakening, for nibbana, just like the cooling of a fire. So the unfashioned, the unbent, the fermentation free, the true, the beyond, the subtle, the very hard to see, the ageless, the undecaying, the featureless, non-elaboration, peace, the deathless, the exquisite, rest, the secure, unbinding, the unafflicted, dispassion, release, the island, shelter, harbor, refuge. So that's just to name a few. Right? So we can take any of those. We can leave it in the more Zen fashion of not saying much at all about it. Or we can take any image, metaphor, phrase, and really take it into the soil of our life, right? So Freud said something, I can't get it exactly right, but about analogy and metaphor, said something like, it's not the answer for everything. Said this in his book on psychoanalysis. It isn't the answer for everything, but it will give you a feeling of coming home, right? Which is itself a metaphor. So trusting the images and resonances that arise whenever we're contemplating a teaching. Right? So all the way through this is the deep vow or aspiration to awaken, the trust that that's possible, and to contribute to that for all beings, right? To help the conditions ripen for all beings. So this is the Bodhisattva vow. This is another through line, but it has tremendous energy, right? And we need tremendous energy if we're going to wrestle with whatever ox we have in our life, right? We need tremendous energy and tremendous heart and all of these brilliant capacities of mind that in the beginning we don't know are there, but as we progress, become more and more radiant, right? Whether other people recognize them or not, they become more and more familiar to us, more and more shining. Okay, so we can endeavor to leave our own footsteps, leave our own traces, helpful traces. I'll just end with this poem, like embodies this for me. Again, this is from one of the verses from the Elder Nuns called Kindness. Metika. And these are also awakening poems. So these, again, are expressions, images that spontaneously arose from the early nuns' shift in view or transformative experiences. Okay, this is Metika, kindness. I know my older sister passed this way. I know my older sister passed this way, its ancestors. At the top of the mountain, I spread my outer robe where perhaps she once spread hers. I set down my bowl, and there was her staff, the twin of my own. Using both staffs, I lowered myself down and leaned back against a large gray rock. I let go of the staffs, and my hands were empty. The mountain went on holding me. I spread my outer robe where perhaps she once spread hers. You can feel the resonance of that. Using both staffs, I lowered myself down and leaned back against a large gray rock. I let go of the staffs and my hands were empty. The mountain went on holding me. So maybe we can just sit for a minute or so. Thank you, everybody, for your attention tonight and your practice. There's a little bit of time for a few comments or questions, your own reflections. We're also going to save some time for announcements as well. I'd love to hear if anybody has anything they'd like to ask or offer. Quiet tonight. That's fine. Yeah, Cheryl. Yeah.
Everybody is quiet. I really appreciated your talk tonight. And when you're talking about, for my own practice.
Can you hear Cheryl?
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know you can't hear out of the speakers.
Okay.
Yeah. It's coming.
It's an illusion.
Yeah, right. Yes, I should speak up. When you talked about reverberations, that's, I think, you know, especially in this past year, it's becoming more and more and more and more apparent that I create my own suffering. By the way, that,
yeah.
By those footsteps,
yeah.
The prince said, I leave behind. Anyway, it's a. I started earlier in my practice when I first learned about dependent origination. I mean, everything was in ignorance.
Yeah,
and it still is in a way. And it's just amazing to me that, you know, that it is, that the practice is, it can be so. I'm not even sure what I'm saying, but it's so simple in the sense that it's, you know, when I get caught in that, whatever, you know, aversion or whatever's going on, and to just be blind, you know, and when you said, what is it? What is your, you know, what's your thing? What's your reaction? Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, you know, and it's just automatic and it happens and it's, but every single time, it happens. There's a, you know, that's just a footprint for me.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's all I really wanted to say about that. Just to, bring that into the room. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, the traces that we leave or that some are helpful, you know, some can be helpful. they can be both. Yeah. 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 But, yeah, owning our own first reaction to things, it's much easier to turn towards a reverberation than it is a whole identity. You know, or a whole story or a whole narrative. It's much easier to turn towards like a felt movement, like, oh, disappointment, you know, or that sting of when we've been hurt. It's easier to turn towards that than to, you know, it's not easy. But the story that we create about it obviously creates layers and layers that we're then struggling with trying to find our way out of. So, yeah, knowing a few of your key moves is really helpful because the body will tell you immediately, oh, I know what's happening here. I'm starting to collapse, you know, I'm starting to withdraw or make my case or whatever it might be. So, but that, you know, that through line through these images too is suffering that doesn't stay as bewilderment, but ripens as search. Oh, is there another way? Right? Then volleying that back one more time. Or, so that's the promise of practice, right? And we need all sorts of skillful means in helping us keep that alive and at the forefront. Absolutely. Yeah. And remind me of your name.
Oh, Carlito.
Carlito, right. Okay.
That was such a good segue. So if I can reiterate, I think you're saying, so what came for me was that I have been, an image will pop in. It's very poignant. My body immediately responds.
Yeah.
But then that was actually my question. I'm not entirely sure what to do with that because it's like, oh, there's a sensation here and sadness and, you know, or what it is, or even watching it spiral into different emotions.
Mm-hmm.
But so were you just suggesting that instead of sort of going there, which is easy, you're suggesting kind of more, I don't know, backing off a little bit and going, oh yeah, I'm responding in this kind of same way that I always do, or I'm not quite sure what.
Yeah, no, I think you would. I think stay with what you were doing in terms of the image. Yeah, don't know, that felt rich and good. It's a way of helping you, like come closer to your experience. Right. And so if that feels like that arises organically, an image, it'll often happen for me when I'm deeply in the body. It's like there aren't a lot of descriptors, like verbal descriptors, but right. An image will come in.
Right. Exactly.
That seems, you know, it doesn't need much. So I would, you know, just stay with it. Let it stay there, you know, lightly in your awareness.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not, you don't have to pull it back or, you know,
yeah,
hold on to it too heavily, but
right. And so there's the delve on one extreme, there's the delving right into
yeah.
it. On the other extreme, it's like, nope,
yep,
not going there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I'm trying to do like a dual awareness thing where I'm maybe like focusing on a grounded sensation and also maybe trying to observe the emotion, sensation, felt sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Keep playing in that.
Keep playing
in that arena.
Yeah.
But yeah. But let the whole kind of attitude and atmosphere be one of kind of light interest.
You know,
like light interest. Oh, let me see. You know.
Well, it's yeah.
Yeah.
Easier said than done.
Easier said than done. But right, but staying in the realm of the felt experience, you can use your breathing. So there's movement mm-hmm. and support and resource. But yeah, that dance of effort between, you know, you don't grab onto the image as being something that's so meaningful and important, but you're not batting it away. Just, okay, mm-hmm. what's the resonance of that?
Since you mentioned breath, often this will invoke a really rabid kind of like, so maybe like kind of just like physically say, okay, I'm just going to slow this down, extend the out breath maybe a little bit or, yeah, okay.
That's helpful. Yeah. And if it seems like the image is provoking that, it might be a time to kind of rest back and let the awareness be more open, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than so intent on an object.
Right.
It might be a time to let awareness be wide.
Yeah. Too.
It can include the body, but
right.
But
yeah. I can see that. Okay, thank
you. Yeah. Okay, great.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the talk. All right, everybody. Well, I hope some of this is useful, and I hope it inspires you to maybe approach teachings in a way where you can really take the images, phrases, and themes that resonate with you and make them your own